Okay, welcome back, everybody. We've got to have a brief presentation now from Glenn Langton, and then we'll open up questions to the full panel. And so if you've got questions that have been reserved from the earlier sessions and from coming up from Glenn's, then you can SMS those to the number before or come to the microphones to each side of the room. Now, we've gone through and talked about sort of retirement risks and some of what's been going on in the regulation area and just risk management for superannuation funds. We'll just spend a little bit of time now talking about communicating risk to members and helping members to understand investment risk. So Glenn will talk to us briefly about some of those issues. Glenn has over 30 years' experience in the superannuation consulting, asset consulting and in management. He's had senior roles with the consulting actuarial divisions of a number of Australian firms, including Mercer, Coopers & Lybrand and Buck Consultants. He's also been responsible for the provision of investment services and asset consultant support and the development of investment products for ING Investment Management. So please welcome Glenn to the stage.
Thanks, Andrew. I'd like to thank Katrina. She's actually, you'll see, handed, I think, the first two of my slides and given you the background to the dashboard. Basically, what I want to do is, I'm a member of the superannuation practice projections and disclosure subcommittee of the SPC, and what our subcommittee's been doing for the last 2 or 3 years is, well, amongst other things, is actually been talking to the regulators and Treasury about how information should be disclosed to members. In particular, the thing that's, I'd have to say, of concern to us at the moment is what's got to be disclosed to members through the dashboard. And so what I just want to do is take 10 minutes to tell you what the Institute's concerns are with those aspects of what's disclosed to the dashboard, given that we probably are concerned about every item on the dashboard. What I should point out very, very much at the moment, and Katrina actually touched on this, is that what APRA has actually implemented is being very much dominated by what government policy is. And so that the comments that I'm going to make about what the Institute thinks are some deficiencies in that material is more a reflection, in fact, it is a reflection on government policy more than what the regulators are actually implementing. So if I talk through the issues with the areas that we're concerned about, is the first of all is that, as Katrina said, basically what you've got to disclose on the dashboard is the return, is the net investment return minus admin and advice fees for a representative member of $50,000 balance. Now, the problem that's occurred is that, in fact, Cooper report was that when it came out, it actually said, introduced this concept of net return. And the difficulty with the net return is that if you talk to the man in the street, they and say, would you like to know what the total balance or how much you actually get at the end? And basically they'll say, yeah, that's really interesting. We're interested in what we get at the end. The problem is that what's happened is that net return is now being used as a metric for comparing superannuation funds. And the problem is that it fails as a metric that people can use as to compare superannuation funds. And it fails in 2 points. First of all is that the metric doesn't allow you to compare the investment performance of superannuation funds. Because you're taking off administration fees as well as investment fees, what you're actually doing is you're comparing a metric that commingles two services, an investment service and the administration service, administration and advice service. So what you're doing is you have one number that actually gives you an indicator of how the commingled services actually perform. So it doesn't actually let you say that if the administration services are, in fact, much better and charging much more because they're actually providing extra services. What will happen is, for the same level of gross investment return or net investment return, you'll end up having a lower net return. So the first thing is that it's as a metric of being able to letting you compare investment return, it just fails. The second thing is that because it's actually a metric that's calculated for the representative member with a $50,000 balance, we've done some work that because the fee in a significant part of the fee in many superannuation funds, in particular industry funds, is actually a fixed dollar figure. What actually happens is that for members with low account balances, the metric for the the representative member actually turns out to be misleading. And so what can happen is that you can have one superannuation fund compared to another superannuation fund where the metric, the net return for the $50,000 balance member favours fund A, but if you actually look at the $10,000 balance member, the fund B is in fact the better fund. So technically, from a comparison point of view, low account balance members are in fact going to be misled by this number. Now this is particularly important. If you actually look at the industry funds, the average account balance for industry funds is about $22,000. Now, clearly there's a lot of members that have multiple account balances, and when we actually get the aggregation of account balances, they'll get bigger. But you've got to assume that there's going to be a lot of members that have total account balances in industry funds that are well less than $50,000. And they, in fact, will potentially be picking superannuation funds based on a metric that's totally inappropriate. The next issue is that the return target, what you've got to actually do is specify a return target, and that return target is not a fixed number. It is actually a margin over CPI. Now, the problem with that is, and Nick has sort of alluded to this, is that generally speaking, what you want to, in fact, have is a target that maintains your standard of living in the future. And to do that, CPI doesn't actually achieve that. You've actually got to relate the target to a WOTI. So again, you've got a target there that doesn't actually provide members with an indicator of how that is going to actually perform going forward and maintaining their standard of living up to retirement. The next thing that you had to put on the dashboard is a risk label. And again, the problem with the risk label is that it's based on the probability of a negative return, or how many negative returns you expect to get in a 20-year period. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that this measures very short-term volatility, and it provides absolutely no guidance as to the risk associated with that investment if you actually have long-term investment horizon. So you can take, for example, that and what you put on the dashboard is actually a label. So the label for this particular investment product will be, this is a low-risk or a high-risk particular product. And the problem is that you're going to find that things like cash, fixed interest, are going to be nominated as low-risk. And the concern that we've got is that the members, particularly my super members, who are basically not engaged, who actually look at this, which one are they going to pick? They're actually going to pick the investment that have low risk. So they're going to end up having their assets sitting in cash or fixed interest, which is going to provide them with, ultimately, given that they might have 20 or 30 year time horizons, going to provide them with less income in retirement. And the final thing is that when you disclose you've got to disclose the admin costs for a representative member. So basically, for a $50,000 member, you actually have to specify what the administration cost will be in dollar terms as a percentage. Now, again, similar to what I've said for about the low balance members, the figures that you actually see as the dollar cost for administration for a $50,000 member, you can have Fund A looks better than Fund B, but if you then look at a $10,000 member balance member, you'll find the reverse is the case. So again, as a comparative metric, it's misleading, and a significant proportion of members will in fact be misled by this particular metric. So what's the Institute been proposing? The first thing is that we strongly believe that the return that's required to be disclosed, and bear in mind that if you recall what Katrina said, is that the legislation actually simply says that you've got to disclose a return. It's APRA that actually determine how that return is calculated, and they've done that in accordance with government policy. So our view is that the return should be the net investment return, so that, and that the big advantage of that is that you don't have to have a representative member there. You can just say that the return and the return target for this investment product is X, and that's applies to every member regardless of their balance. That we believe that the return target should be based on a WOTI rather than CPI. At the moment it's CPI. It should be based on a WOTI, again, because we feel that the member should be aware of how that investment return is going to help them achieve and maintain the standard of living relative to the rest of the workforce going forward. We believe that there's got to be a long-term risk measure included. We have no problem about a short-term risk measure being included in the dashboard, but we believe at the same time you've actually got to include a long-term risk measure, and what we've suggested is that it's the probability of the return exceeding a WOTI by 3% over a 20-year period. Some work that the subcommittee has done is demonstrated that you need to actually have that 3% gap to get a differentiation. So if you just simply said what's the probability of actually exceeding a WOTI over a 20-year period, you suddenly find that most investment products will in fact have low risk because they exceed a WOTI. You actually need a 3% gap to actually give a proper differentiation. And the final thing that we're suggesting is that at the moment, as I said, your administration fees are disclosed for a $50,000 member. What we're saying is you've got to include a $10,000 member as well, so that members can actually get a feel for what the relativities are. What we're doing going forward, I was very pleased that Katrina said that basically the net return is driven by government policy. And clearly, if the Institute is going to make a change there, we actually need to get the government to change the policy. We'll know in 2 or 3 weeks or a couple of weeks what government that is. And so what our objective is to in fact, put forward proposals or work with the government to, in fact, make sure that they introduce or introduce appropriate metrics for the choice dashboard. The choice dashboard is to come in by June next year. We've got an opportunity to, in fact, engage with the government and Treasury and then APRA and ASIC to, in fact, work out what's to go on that choice dashboard. And what we're hoping is if we can actually move to our proposals on the choice dashboard, then it won't be a big step to say, well, let's bring that back into the MySuper dashboard. That's all. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, everyone. So it's up on the screen at the moment. There's the SMS number, so if you want to text through any questions you have, and also there's microphones if anyone wants to make their way to ask a question. Just to kick off proceedings, we've had a couple of the presentations now that talked about AWOTI and CPI, and in the break I was talking to someone who was from a fund who's talking about their return objectives are cash-based, so that's cash plus 1%, the cash option, and this one's cash plus 1%, this one's cash plus 2%, so there are lots of different things out there. I'm taking from some of the discussion we've had and some of the presentations that we might even be moving towards a situation where a WOTI might make sense to keep up with community living standards through the period up to retirement and for a period beyond through an active phase, but beyond that, moving to a CPI-based improvement or indexation might be appropriate in the passive stage, and then maybe going to a different CPI measure completely again, which incorporates higher health costs and sort of old-aged CPI as a standard beyond that. Nick, first, then maybe Glenn, have any comments on that?
I agree. My main point in that area would be, and this, you know, it's an interesting discussion point and an important one. I don't think we can afford a WOTI is probably the way I'd put it down. I think there's just I understand fully the baby boomers would not like to see themselves fall below what their sons and daughters are growing at, but I just think we face a reality that the system's only 20 years old, the balances aren't there to support that, so it almost comes down to if we're going to encourage people to have an income stream that sort of fits their needs over time, and as Andrew's alluded to, at the end of life, there's every chance that that health and health in particular costs will spiral at some different rate of increase. I think to sort of set up a system that anticipates that they're going to keep pace with the working community is sort of doomed to fail.
The first thing is that what I'm coming at from the point of view of comparative metrics, right? So the question is, when you have on the dashboard comparing the target return for Fund A with the target return for Fund B, and importantly, when you actually, so not only do you have your target return, what you do is you actually have you have the actual return, and you have the actual target as sort of reported historically, right? So our view, and we did some numbers on this, is that if you have on there a target that's based on a WOTI, when you look at the actual experience, what you'll do, so if you accept that an AWOTI-based target is an appropriate target. I accept Nick's point that, you know, we might not be able to achieve it, but that doesn't take away from the fact that it is an appropriate target to have, because if a person in retirement... Well, it's not a person in retirement. If a 30-year-old finds that by the time they get to 60 and retire, that instead of being able to live just like their neighbours... You know, sort of basically they find that the amount of money that they've got there hasn't maintained the standard of living that they actually have in retirement, that they're going to find, they'll feel that, it hasn't achieved what they were trying to achieve. So what we did was, if you base the target on a WOTI and then report on a WOTI, if you don't achieve that, you can actually look at the history, and you can, if your history... if your actual returns don't achieve that, then you actually get a feel for whether it's failing, whether the investment is actually failing to achieve what you're going to get in retirement. With respect to the post-retirement area, I think that rather than... I think a WOTI is still appropriate, but what I think is important is to change, just like Nick did, he actually changed the proportion of a WOTI that you actually have to achieve. I think the way that you sort of address the issue of what happens in retirement is to change the actual purchasing pattern. And so it's not so much change a WOTI to CPI. What you do is you say, if as a person who's in that level, I want to, you know, basically for up to 75, I'm an active person, I want to feel that when I'm 75, I'll be able to buy the same TVs that everybody else will be able to buy. But I recognise that, you know, God willing, that I'm 85, I'm going to be decrepit and sort of won't be rushing around the place. So I think the answer is to change the actual spending pattern.
Yeah, so how we communicate and educate the community around those things will be an even greater challenge. And based on the information we have, so Katrina, you talked a bit earlier about some ugly data that we have, and particularly, I think, in relation to investment information. How is APRA going to be publishing some of this data and also managing this ugly data coming into you, and you know, what sort of process did you have in place to do your best with that data?
Well, in this first year, we currently have a whole variety of data quality controls on the data before it gets submitted, and so we've put all of those in place. Our supervisors are all geared up to, when the first lot of data comes in, do a bit of a reality check with just what they know about the fund and does it look ballpark right. To some degree, we probably the best way of improving the quality of the data will be to actually publish it, and then people, it'll be, you know, the thousand eyes looking at it and go, oh, okay, gee, that really didn't make sense, and then the data gets revised and improved that way. So I think we're just probably going to have a whole bunch of disclaimers on the data for the first year, and educate the users of the data to, you know, which areas are more solid than other areas, and hopefully through that iterative process in 2014, 2015, it's a lot more stable.
Okay. Moving on, Tim, just you looking at the financial condition reports, and we were talking earlier about consistency across the financial services area and in the banking and insurance areas as well, and certainly across all the facets in the insurance industry, financial condition reports are actually compulsory. Do you see a point in time in the future where financial conditions report will become compulsory for superannuation funds?
Whoever asked that one, thank you very much. It's got APRA next to me here, so that's a really good one.
I thought that was you.
Yeah, thank you. I think that we need to think about where we are today and where we might be tomorrow. Long term, I think there's great merit in making it regulated, but I stress long term. I think in the short term, probably the benefit will be from actually making it a voluntary, to actually get funds to actually put these in place themselves. The reason for that, I come back to the point that when it's a long list of regulation, and we've all had that for the last 2 years, there's a great danger you go back to tick the box, I've done one of these. You say, yeah, I've been through the exercise, and it sits on the shelf. If it's voluntary, though, and particularly this will be an interesting one, if the board, if it's for the board or if it's for management, you can actually do both if it's voluntary. If it's compulsory, you probably have to choose an either-or for a fund. There are different needs of the different groups. But if it's a voluntary and you don't have to give it to APRA, just imagine that. It's an internal document for the eyes of the board only. How valuable that would be for them to think about things holistically. So at this stage, Andrew, I'd be saying no, but long-term, I think it would be great value and hence benefit for everyone to make it compulsory.
And just to follow on from that, I guess, Katrina, I'm not sure if you've had experience with you or your colleagues in the insurance industry itself, but from my understanding, that the engagement between the regulator and some of the boards around risks and financial conditions is actually quite valuable as well, in addition to that?
Oh, I think APRA is very supportive of the work that the Actuaries Institute is doing around the financial condition report. We just weren't of a mind to make it compulsory at this stage. And so I do think that, yes, the experience in the general insurance and life insurance industry is that those are reports that our supervisors do look at and get value out of, and see that the regulated institutions get value out of them as well. So I think it's an area that we're going to be watching with a lot of interest. You know, time will tell whether or not it does become something that gets incorporated into our regulatory framework, or whether it just is always something that's on the side.
So just a reminder, if you want to text through your questions, the number's up on the screen, and there's still microphones there for you to ask questions from the floor. Give you a moment. Rod, just to turn to you for a moment, just looking at some defined benefit matters. Do you have any expectations around the size of the super industry going forward with particularly defined benefits, with lots of funds closing?
Well, I guess that at this stage, I guess we're seeing more likely to be a reduction as opposed to any kind of expansion. Again, new DB funds probably just don't occur at the moment. We don't really have any anticipation that they will occur going forward. As to the funds which are there, most of them, I guess, are just going along. A lot of them are close to new members. I guess there is always some kind of leakage, some kind of reduction in numbers, but we're not expecting there to be anything significantly, I guess, in the short term. But obviously, like I said, we don't expect there to be anything really, any new funds coming on board going forward.
And for defined benefit funds closing, do you think that'll accelerate? When we say closing, I mean, I'm almost all closed to new members now, but closing completely and finding an exit strategy?
Probably not at this stage. I think there's been a lot of changes in the last 5-10 years, and I guess if they've weathered a lot of these changes now, they're probably unlikely to close at this point. A lot of the funds would have made those choices when licensing first came in, and then all through this current process, they would have probably made those decisions as to whether to remain open or to close down. So I'd imagine that a lot of them would probably continue going on for now.
Sorry. Yeah, I was just wondering if I could add to that. What kind of experiencing, though, as well is, if you really look at a typical defined benefit a sub-plan, many of those, when they were put in place, it was because they were the existing members, there might be 300 people in that category, often closed mid-90s. Now we're 15, 20 years on, you're often down to, say, 20 people. When you start to think about that, there's actually many trustees and sponsoring employers who are saying, actually, enough is enough at this stage, and now is the time, with all the changes and the complexity, to actually say, I'm going to use this opportunity to buy them out, to transfer them. So actually have experience in seeing some movement in these small DB subplans, which I think is the biggest group.
Yep. So, Glenn, whilst the 3% above AWOTI might be required to differentiate the outcomes for different asset strategies, will that actually encourage people to take more investment risk? And just taking into account the recent performance through the GFC up until the most recent year, that risk metric will encourage people to stay in their low-risk investments, which will presumably be high equity strategies. Do you have any comments on that?
Thank you for whoever's SMS'd that question. It actually allows me to talk about a personal pet beef about the industry, in that there's a general commentary on the expectation or the investment time horizon for people that retire or approaching retirement, that these people have a short-term investment horizon. And therefore, they should in fact be taking a more conservative approach to their investments. That is in fact totally incorrect. What you do have is that you do have the expectation that there may be part of their retirement savings that they will need for a short-term capital outlay or the trip overseas or something like that. So there is an expectation that a proportion of their retirement accounts is in fact very short term, but in fact the balance of that really has a retirement an investment horizon of probably 20 years. Now the difference between the accumulation stage and the retirement stage is that clearly in the retirement stage you need to be able to there's a drawdown, right? So you actually need to be able to generate some income out of that asset, so that does change your investment profile. But the facts are that you should, in fact, have for a big chunk of your investments in retirement, it should be invested heavily in equities to, in fact, maintain a long-term return. So the answer is yes. I'm hoping that the risk measure, the long-term risk measure, will in fact mean that those people that properly recognise that their long-term investment horizon in retirement is in fact 15 years, something like that, that they will in fact continue to have a higher exposure to equities. But also, again, if they actually understand what's happening, they will identify that there is in fact a proportion, 100,000, whatever it is, that they in fact need to have when they get to retirement, and it does have a short-term effect. They can't afford to have that hit by GFC, so they in fact will have 100,000 invested in a low-risk, short-term volatility product, and they'll have the balance of it invested in, maybe not low-risk, but sort of a balanced portfolio. So a combination of reasonable risk, long-term risk, and low-risk cash.
Well, I'll just throw in before, I was going to throw to you next, Nick, for that, but also throwing in the next question as well that's come from the floor, does regarding the disclosure of risk and the investment volatility and the impact of CPI, Is it useful to talk to people about the risk of outliving your retirement savings in that same context of average weekly earnings? I think one of the things that picked up from your presentation earlier as well is also for a lot of people, the present value of the age pension means a lot of people have got a defined benefit asset, and that we're talking about a residual asset on top of what's already a large defined benefit asset for most people as well.
Yep. Thanks. So perhaps just a brief comment on the first question that Glenn's just addressed. The only thing I just want to add to that is that I think funds need to pay more heed perhaps to something that's sort of implied by that question, which is members' risk preferences. So, yes, the idea that members need to have a high risky asset exposure to support an income that and in fact an investment framework or to time horizon rather that might last another 20 or 30 years is valid. But I think equally we need to give weight to the fact that, you know, the sort of stats we hear, like that on the day a member retires, their risk tolerance reduces by, you know, factor of five times, according to some studies. So we don't want to encourage undue conservatism, but I don't think we can ignore the fact that if we sort of default members into something that's a higher risk strategy than what they're comfortable with, then there's a risk that during a GFC they'll throw their hands up and say this is all too hard and sort of permanently move to cash or take their money out and spend it on something inappropriate. So risk tolerance to me is a factor that needs, or risk preference, if you like, is a factor that needs to be weighted into this discussion as well. On the point on risk of outliving your savings, yes, I think that's a really important measure. So this is the idea that for a given strategy, you can come up with a metric based, again, on a bunch of assumptions, including expectations of life, that says this strategy has, you know, a 70% chance, 80% chance of lasting for your retirement, or alternatively you have 20, 30% chance of running out before your retirement under this strategy. I think it's a very powerful metric that's used a lot for assessing different strategies. Like any metric, it's not perfect, and one particular shortcoming I'd point to is when you're talking about strategies that involve some sort of annuitisation or some sort of longevity insurance, then it gets a bit tricky, because if you buy some insurance, then technically you never run out of that particular money. And as Andrew said, you've also got the age pension, but even above that, you've got money strategies which never run out, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're always a better strategy. But on that metric, they would give you zero chance of running out. But there are ways around that. You can introduce ideas like, you know, sort of a utility concept, where how close are you to a target income for the whole of your life, which sort of gets around that. Not saying any of these would be easy to mandate in a sort of product disclosure or a dashboard type sense, but in a more general sense, we've found them very useful to sort of actually compare quite disparate strategies in retirement on a sort of an even basis.
Just the comment I've got on this is that one of the problems I have about focusing on something lasting to 90 is that it's sort of 90 becomes a point. It's assuming that 100% of people live to 100, which is obviously not right. The problem that I see, and the difficulty of managing investments in retirement, is that, and it's not quite right, but let's say 50% of people are not going to actually reach 90. Right. Now, the problem you've got is if you actually manage your assets on the basis that you're going to last to 90, then something like 50% of the people are actually going to end up having a lower standard of living than they really could have had, because they're going to die early. I think that, you know, one of the most under-researched areas at the moment is how you actually manage investments in retirement to cope, to, you know, the person that dies after 10 years who's lived on sort of very low incomes because they were concerned they were going to go to 90 has suffered substantially when they shouldn't have. But again, the problem is, of course, if they last to 100 and they broke it at 90, you've got a problem.
I know Nick will be itching to say something about that, so I will give you one more chance at that before I move on to some other questions. But so it does come back to some research being done around the world around deferred annuities, and we saw the announcement on the 5th of April this year about making the regulatory changes to legitimise and make deferred annuities in Australia on a same tax footing as other retirement income products. But that pooling of longevity risk so that age 90 isn't the age, and we can bring that forward at least to age 85 or 80 so that the people that die, there's less at risk of being underused. Do you have any comments just around that at the moment, Nick?
I think, I mean, people have a sort of emotional reaction sometimes when you mention annuities, and often those emotions are negative out there in the sort of retirement discussions that we have. So, I mean, I almost prefer to talk about this concept of pooling, some sort of sharing of experience to address the point that that Glenn's mentioned just seems to me to make sense. And then, you know, we can devolve that down into individual products which address that in some way. But to me, at a conceptual level, the first thing that we just somehow need to embrace is the fact that the system is very much based on an individual ownership of assets, not just in the build-up phase, but all the way through. And somehow recognising through the sort of examples that we're talking about, whereas if everyone saves enough to give them a sort of a low probability of running out of money, then a number of those, 50% of those, roughly, will have saved too much given their own experience. So that's just a fundamental issue that we can't invest our way out of that problem. There's no investment strategy that deals with that. We need to somehow embrace, in my view, the idea of pooling experience. Now, how you do that, and you know, whether it's an annuity product, whether it's some sort of softer guarantee than an annuity provides, but that gives an element of sharing, I think is really a discussion that the industry needs to have.
Now, I'm not sure if this is the right question for you, Tim, or not, but given I'm not sure how close you were to the retirement trust at Mercer for the top question there that's come through around, are you aware at all of, in a master trust environment, whether the defined benefit sub-funds have multiple VBI shortfall limits, and so the administrative burden that will be placed on the trustee to manage that different level of multiple funds within the fund?
I can't actually answer the specific question, but just trying to think about that from what I would imagine on that. I think you'll discover that the administration setup is such that you are able to have the separate targets for each subplan. In fact, it's really important to do so, and they will vary considerably from subplan to subplan. So I think by extending from that the trustees will be able to cope with that. The issue, of course, will be what if some of those employees don't want to do that and how you force them down a certain direction.
Because I think at the end of the day, that's going to be pushed back on. If each sub-fund has their own actuary, then it's actually the actuary who'll be responsible for that administration burden, just reporting through to the trustee.
That's exactly right.
Yep. Turning to either Rod or Katrina, just on the ORFR, so it looks like it's Katrina, just the levels, can you give us some idea of what levels have been set up around the various funds, or have you seen some of those yet, and the sort of analysis in your discussions with funds, that how deep the analysis was to come up with the numbers that were ultimately accepted?
Well, I think in our Prudential Practice Guide, we said quite clearly a guidance level of 25 basis points of FUM, and at this stage of introducing this new financial requirement to the industry, APRA's quite conservative about reliance on models, and just because we think it's an emerging area. We have the experience of op risk modelling in the other industries we regulate, and I guess our view is that those are still evolving and improving. And so to start with superannuation and immediately kick off with a focus on modelling, we didn't want to go down that route, and I think we're going to tread softly into that area, and at this stage would are more taking an approach of holding a conservative line of that 25 basis point level and then learning from experience over time. So we're interested in seeing what analysis people are doing, but it's a big part is are the right risks being included rather than some op risks being ignored. So there isn't going to be a single approach that works for everybody. We think it'll take time for loss data experience to build up and for that data to be shared across the industry, and so we're expecting that the analysis will get more in depth as time goes on. At this stage, we've seen a variety of approaches, but where models have suggested quite a low level of ORFR be used, APRA has encouraged that the 25 basis points number really be a floor at this stage.
Okay, thank you. Rod, just moving on to you, just quickly, there's a question comes through about the rectification period being for longer than 3 years. What matters would be considered for allowing a rectification period longer than 3 years?
I guess, as you're aware, in the standard, we do set the longest period as being 3 years for the rectification period if we go on below your shortfall limit. That being said, obviously we haven't ruled out allowing longer periods, but in those cases, the trustee would actually have to approach APRA and to request something longer. At this stage, it's hard to actually say what things can be taken into consideration, because basically, in all these kind of situations, we take them on a case-by-case basis. So it will come down to the circumstances of the fund itself, its employer sponsor. But obviously, we'd be taking into account, I guess, a range of items. And as long as the trustee can actually justify why it would take longer than necessary, then we are happy to consider those approaches. And obviously the employer sponsor is going to be a big part of that. For example, if there are... one of the common ones we actually have is government-backed funds, which fall out inside this regime. A lot of them say, well, we have government backing and we have guarantees to make payments. That could be a scenario where we may allow a longer period if there is a guarantee from the employer or something that backing them that can be enforceable, that they will be able to contribute it under a longer period. But overall, it will just come down to the fund, the circumstances of the fund itself, and the justification from the trustee.
Can I just follow up with a question to Katrina in this whole area? In your presentation on the risk management framework, you referred to looking for evidence of lines of defence being in place. Can you just expand on what you have in mind there and what you've actually seen? I appreciate you've only so far really seen my super authorisations talking in terms of how they're applying the new standards and interpreting them. But thank you.
Okay. I think... I had the words lines of defence there probably as a guideline, I suppose. We're not really going anything formal down that route, but we introduced the risk management function as one of the requirements in the risk management framework, and that has actually been an area where there's been quite a lot of questions from various entities and really seeking a lot more guidance from APRA. And so it's part of the discussions that supervisors are having to explore how risk management actually works within the organisations is, okay, who's doing the role of the risk management function? It might be a group of people, and it might vary for different business units within a fund, but I guess to help guide those conversations, the question from APRA of, okay, well, what are the lines of defence in place from your perspective? So what role is the risk management function playing and what role is the business unit playing? It's just a useful framework for exploring how risk management is actually working. We're not sort of mandating anything formal, but it has been a useful framework to just get entities to start articulating who is doing what and where those layers of risk management actually are.
Well, following on from that then, Tim, there are a lot of risk professionals, and you mentioned accountants as one out there, but there are a lot of other, there's a risk professions association, I think, out there, so a lot of other professionals in the space. So why do actuaries have any advantage in this area, or what's the role that actuaries can play in the whole risk management framework?
Sure, that's actually a really important question for our audience here today. As actuaries, most of us in the room, we think, well, of course actuaries have a role in risk management. It's what we do. We make certainty out of uncertainty. Of course you're going to use actuaries. But you go and talk down the street, and the lawyers are saying, no, I'm a risk manager, I understand risk. You go to a CRO, and they're often not an actuary. They're someone else from a compliance background, say, or an IT specialist even. And then the accountants as well think they can do everything. So you put it all together, and I actually think actuaries do have a really, really important role, because we can understand data, we can understand numbers, we can understand stats, we can see trends perhaps a lot more than other professionals. But to conclude, I think perhaps it is actuaries with the skills that we have, rather than being actuaries with a big A, is the reason that you'd use an actuary in risk management. So I think actuaries have to work with other professions, but I think actuaries have a really unique area to add in this area, and perhaps one that isn't used to the extent that it should be.
Some questions have come through. So to Nick, do you think the government needs to further increase the superannuation guarantee contributions? Now, I'm not sure whether that's from the 9 to the 12 or 12 and beyond again, in order to increase the awareness of individuals to save for a comfortable retirement, whatever that is.
If I was from APRA, I'd say we're in a caretaker period, so I can't answer that question. Well, it's been asked. I mean, my personal view, and I recognise the other views, I think that if we take the 12 as given, I would say for Australia that for a compulsory level 12 is enough. I do recognise the... There's a school of thought that said that should continue on to 15, but clearly in a real world sense that doesn't seem to be on the cards for a while anyhow, until we've had the 12 fully phased in. Having said that, and harking back to earlier comments, I think if we do go to a 15 in the future, I'd certainly like to see any additional increases not simply plugged into the system as it stands, but in some sort of pooling arrangement to pick up the tail. I think, in fact, we missed an opportunity, perhaps, with the 9 going to 12, to argue the case that 1 or 2% of that was in some sort of pooling or insurance arrangement, rather than just going into the same accumulation pot as the existing 9. So that would be my view. In terms of... The question was to increase the awareness of individuals to save for a comfortable retirement. I mean, that's clearly a goal we all have. The ways in which I think we need to work on that are better communication and debate of the issues that we've been talking about today. And if there was a change that we could do to help increase the sort of adequacy of the system in the short term, I mean, I think a barrier is... for many people are these caps of 25,000. I know that's been increased, but they're still a lot lower than they used to be. And with a lot of people approaching retirement trying to play catch-up, they're a barrier to that.
Well, Tim, do you have any comments on that as well? And also, just there's been some discussion in the last few weeks, and I think going back earlier than that as well, about having lifetime caps instead. And we know that the tax office used to administer undeducted contributions, and so administering a lifetime cap would be possible. Do you have any thoughts just to throw that in as well?
And can I mention reasonable benefit limits? Remember them? On those and the different ones?
No,
I won't mention those. I think the whole debate here really needs to be about outcomes, and that's what we're hearing from everybody today. We're talking about what's your different investment risks, short-term, long-term, but really it's all coming down to what's enough in retirement and how that changes over different parts in retirement. So as you look at that and the limits there,
It is very hard when you focus on the individual, yet you have people part of a couple, for example. How do you put those together? You start to think about people in the workforce, out of the workforce at different times. How do you play catch-up? What's enough? And I would really like to see the debate moving away from inputs to outputs, I think, actually, Andrew. So I'm not answering your question, but I'm turning it round as I think we need to change the conversation to enable that to happen.
So I'll pass back along to Nick again, and then I'm on to Glenn. But Nick, just the next question that came through, and Tim just mentioned that there, about the likelihood of products which consider super or retirement income from the couple's perspective rather than at the individual level. And you mentioned that about 70% of people enter retirement as a couple, but we continue to manage information and money for individuals.
Yeah, we do. In the old style annuity space, those exist where you have reversions to a spouse. So I think we need to adapt that policy to the new world where funds don't have that information. So the best they can do at the moment is really to manage and to communicate and to set targets, often based on an individual and what their savings is in the pot. But if they can use what they have to engage members and encourage them to actually deliver that information back to the fund, then funds, I think, can then set about actually designing products, smart defaults, as I call them. So it might still be within some sort of default setting, but it might be modified by the information that the member feeds back to the fund. So, you know, what I'm thinking of is a fund sets a member along a path, encourages them by engaging with them to say, do you have a spouse? What are their savings? That information feeds back in, and that might alter the path or the default settings that member then has. So the extent that can work, and technology does allow that to work, I think the technology side is relatively simple. I think it's the engagement side and getting members engaged and understanding these issues and encouraging them to feed that information in is a tricky bit that we need to work on.
So Glenn?
I just want to go back to the question of whether the SGC should be increased. One of the problems I have about this area is that the discussion seems to be very simplistic. It says, what sort of income do you actually have to generate, and with the focus on superannuation, to maintain a certain standard of living after retirement. One of the things that one of the early slides demonstrated the importance of the person's home, individual's home, in terms of their overall investments at retirement. So that I think one of the problems about increasing the compulsory contributions is that will be actually taken straight out of the people's salary. So the big advantage for the person's home is obviously, one is that they can gear it. Any money that they can put into their own home, the geared sort of, you know, $1 generates $9 of gearing. And the second thing is that it's basically the capital and capital appreciation is tax-free. So for a lot of people, an investment in their own home is in fact a much better investment than investing in superannuation, particularly at low income levels. So that the first thing to say is, when determining how much money needs to be put into superannuation, what you need to do is you actually need to look at the total investments of that person when they have at retirement, and what's the best way for that person's income to be used to generate that income. The second thing is to say, again, when we talk about what people need to have in retirement, I'm a firm believer that when you get to the frail age, the Nick's frail age, that typically what will happen is people at that age will move into some sort of retirement village or nursing home, or so they will basically sell their own home and move into other accommodation that will typically be much less expensive than the house that they're in, particularly if you're living in one of the capital cities. So that in determining what you need to have in retirement and how much you need to allocate in the superannuation, you actually have to think about, one, whether the home is a better investment, and two, how that home will in fact be used to finance your income requirements and capital requirements closer to, well, close to old age.
A very quick addition. I agree with that. And, I mean, thinking holistically, you know, why shouldn't super funds actually own, you know, retirement villages? Not purely from an investment vehicle point of view, but thinking holistically, if their job is to deliver a retirement with dignity, then facilitating that swap of home equity to a lower cost living arrangement and freeing up assets to be used for spending, you know, I think that's something that funds need to think about.
So there's probably an area of research that still needs to be done through whichever organisation can do it. It's actually, I mean, we're getting the anecdotal evidence from financial planners and others, but how are people going to use the money in retirement, including their other assets or the own home? At what stage do they sell that down or access capital through reverse mortgages? What will the behaviour look like? And at the moment, we're doing a lot of guessing, and because a lot of the time, we're talking people have only had superannuation for a short period of time. As that emerges as a bigger asset, how is that interplay going to change? And maybe that's the next big bit of research we need. Are there any questions from the floor at this stage? Just keep sending them through. There's a number coming through the SMS, but okay. Just moving back to Katrina. There's been a big project for the last few years within APRA. How have all the APRA supervisors coped with all of the additional workload that's been going on, and what's the next year or two look like from that perspective as well?
I think we've got internal fatigue as well across the board, so it's been you know, a big change for all participants in the industry. And I think the one thing that, just focusing on the super reforms, that we sort of forget is that for the financial conglomerates that APRA regulates, we've had the changes to the life and general insurance capital, we've had Basel III, we're doing the conglomerate regulation plus super. So really we've touched pretty much every part of the business operations. And so for our supervisors that are across all of those, that's it's not just super, it's everything. So, but I think what the real strength that has come out over the last 2 years is that the supervisory relationship with the entities, for a large part, works really well and has already been a very close interaction, and that was really quite important over the last few years. So there has been a lot of dialogue and a lot of willingness, I guess, from entities to admit to APRA that they don't understand a certain element, or they don't think that they are on track to achieve something. And so working with their supervisor to nut through problems, as opposed to the supervisor being someone you never talk to or you only talk to through sort of formal communications. So that actually has meant over the last couple of years that our supervisors, as we were developing the prudential standards, the supervisors had a lot of examples of how things would work for their particular entities that they knew, and from the small corporate funds to the master trusts with hundred DB sub plans, and so that wealth of knowledge has sort of helped inform how we created the regulations, and also the feedback that we got through all of the consultations did actually help shape as much as we could the requirements to be more practical where they could. So I think although everybody is quite overwhelmed with the changes, the strength of the interaction and the positive view of entities that they will actually continue, that it has been a benefit to interact closely with APRA and they expect that going forward, has actually been a really good outcome out of this, and so should make the next couple of years fairly straightforward.
So now we've got that great working relationship. What changes does APRA or you expect to see in the superannuation industry over the next few years?
Well,
and beyond.
Yeah, the funny thing is that we've got prudential standards now, and that has been very important for APRA to get prudential standards. But we have been regulating super without prudential standards for you know, the last 10 years or so, or 15 years APRA's been operating now. And for the 98% of super funds out there, we don't actually expect that we will be supervising to the letter of the standard. The standard, as Rod said, sort of codifies some practice, but we will be using the moral suasion and just the conversations with the management and with the boards to encourage prudent behaviour. The good thing is now with the prudential standards, or from our perspective, we now have a framework of if there is non-compliance and the moral suasion doesn't work, then APRA can actually direct a trustee to comply with the prudential standards. And we didn't have that straightforward, formal framework in the past. But for the vast majority of the industry, we never expect to use those rules. So hopefully the prudential standards don't actually change the relationships too much. And so really the supervision, a big part of it is the relationship is going to keep going the way it has been going.
So you have conversations, responses to that, and work through things together, but if there's a board that just won't listen or respond, then you have powers to act.
Yeah, we now have those powers. I think a big learning through the prudential standards has been we did see a flurry of applications for exemptions from various parts of the standards. And so there has been an education process about the principles-based approach to say, actually, your risk management function, no, we're not going to give you an exemption from having a risk management function. We think you need to have one, but we don't actually have a view as what the shape and form of that would actually be. Internal audit, we had some applications saying, no, we don't want to have internal audit because we're going to outsource that. And we said, well, you don't actually need an exemption. That's allowed within the prudential standard. We don't say the internal audit has to be internal to your company. So thanks for your application to get an exemption, but you're actually complying. So there is a bit of an education, I think, from of how prudential standards actually provide flexibility of how to implement the framework.
Tim, in your presentation, you were talking about financial modelling and stress testing. And one of the things that has worried me for a little while was in the absence of financial modelling, particularly around the cash flows that you were talking about, the contributions in and stress testing with day change and benefit payments going out, is that at the same time as in the last few years, that we're going to a cash where the system's maturing a little bit and the cash flow will change, that a lot of funds have been moving into less liquid investments. And so when you're buying illiquid investments, that's easy to manage. But when the cash flow hump turns and you now start to need to become a net seller of illiquid investments, that becomes a whole different ballgame. So that's the cash flow projection information that you're looking at and that actuaries can provide, or can you talk about that a bit more?
Absolutely. This is actually really interesting and really important. And when you look at this, it's actually fascinating to me that trustees haven't done this historically. And I guess that's because the funds until more recently have been quite immature with the build-up of funds. When you start to look at the cash flow, contributions in, investment returns, less expenses and the benefit payments, we conducted an analysis a couple of years ago and it showed that this fund, and I'm sure there are lots of funds like this, in about 3 years' time, you're actually going to have more outflows than you are inflows. And as soon as that happens, it changes probably the whole way you need to manage the fund. You need to ask, do you have sufficient scale? I mean, one of the tests that you have Is that going to work for your fund in the future? Do you need to find a way of more members? Do you need to find a way of investing a different way, particularly when people have not only investment choice but fund choice? You're not actually quite sure how things are going to go. So when you put all this together, liquidity risk is a really, really big risk for superannuation boards. I know that APRA in the past has been looking at this, perhaps when it wasn't enforceable before you. And I know that trustees weren't looking at this sufficiently, and I know that the models actually do really help you think about that future risk as opposed to today's risk. And that's why I think it's a valuable exercise to conduct by every board.
And a question's come through for Katrina on across the whole industry. Are there any stress test scenarios that APRA does on the industry as a whole, looking with the data that you have at your disposal?
I think probably the answer is that we haven't done stress tests on the super industry internally within APRA. We've done a number of stress tests in the other industries, but no, this is probably a new area for us. I think around the when the GFC was happening with the DB funds, we did some work there looking essentially sort of continuing the negative turn in the market to see how much worse things might get. But broadly across the whole super industry, this isn't really something that we've done internally.
Glenn, just turning to you for a moment, communicating retirement risks and in particular in relation to ASIC's class order, we've had some discussions with ASIC over the times about that. Have you seen any practical issues in dealing with the class order or any issues that we still have with that going forward? Because it deals with couples, and just talk through a bit about the class order.
Oh, this is the class order that... well, going back, I mean, basically the government decided that they wanted to engage superannuation members, and they thought that one of the ways that they could do this was to actually provide projections of their final retirement benefits at the same time as they provided the annual certificate, the annual member certificates to the members. The problem that they had, the problem was that they wanted to do this in a way that funds could do this without actually providing personal advice to members. And so what they did is they wanted to develop a very simple projection model that funds could actually use that virtually took away from the trustees any ability to make decisions about what the assumptions would be and how they'd use the data. So it was going to be a fixed formula that was used. The problem that occurred was that the first drafts of this came out, in particular, the data that was used to do these projections, to make things simple, was, for example, one of the things that the original class order did, and in fact the current one did, was simply said that you had to use your contributions that were paid in the last year and assume that those contributions continued on in the future. And the difficulty, of course, with that was that if you had any lump sum one-off contributions that were made in the last year, just picking up last year's contributions and assuming those continued into the future was totally inappropriate. Another problem, of course, was that they effectively assumed that, was a fixed rate of return that was going to be earned on the account balances, and this rate of return was appropriate for a balanced portfolio. The problem, of course, is if the member was actually invested in a cash balance or a conservative balance, then the expectation is that the returns that the member was going to achieve would be significantly less than what was in the projection, and therefore, in both of those examples, the projection that was going to come out was going to be significantly higher than what the member could actually achieve. The Institute, and you'd all would have received it, we wrote to ASIC, and we also wrote to our members saying, you know, these are the problems with it. The the ASIC has actually come back with a significant number of changes. I mean, and one of the big changes that we've been looking for was the introduction to be able to include the age pension in these projections. Again, our feeling was very definitely that for many members of superannuation funds, the age pension is going to be a very important part of their retirement income to provide them with projections that didn't have the retirement the age pension. It was pretty much a waste of time, so we wanted trustees to have the ability to actually include that. So ASIC have come back with a variety of changes that we, most of which we are quite happy with. I'd say that we trustees have much more flexibility in being able to tailor make changes to the basic fixed assumptions to actually make the projections more relevant to the members. The problem is that, practically speaking, how trustees actually, if they have the administrative capabilities to be able to determine whether it's one-off contributions or, you know, so how they actually implement that, particularly for large funds that have, you know, hundreds of thousands of members, you don't want to set up a system that costs you a fortune to look after a handful of members. The expectation is that we're going to have many superannuation funds are going to actually start producing these projections, and the hope is that we will get better engagement with members. And that's, you know, the government's position was, we don't expect this projection to be actually used as a financial planning tool. It was more that if members were sent this information, particularly if, and Nick's numbers suggest that, you know, that they look at this, the number that comes out, and it will be much lower than what they really wanted to have on retirement. And therefore, at a younger age, you know, sort of basically 30, 35, 40, they actually start looking at superannuation and saying, well, the superannuation fund's not going to provide me with adequate retirement income. I need to do something about it. And that's the primary objective of this. So, and I think we're going to achieve that.
Yeah, one of the aha moments that came through in that is those discussions, I think, with ASIC was that people will get this information every year, and so that getting that prediction right the first time they get something wasn't actually the aim. It was to gradually build up information over, so a 40-year-old would get 27 of these statements before they retired, and so that gradual process was more the name of the game. Nick, just while on the same topic, I mean, I understand you've been doing some work with some clients in this area, but with some of the practical issues that you've encountered?
Yeah, we have sort of gone and implemented what's out there at the moment for a number of funds. So they're early adopters, if you like. I think the broad comment first would be that the main change from what perhaps funds have seen before is a focus on income. So the fact that they're not just projecting a lump sum out to retirement, they're actually doing their best, and it does involve more complexities, but they're showing an income together with the age pension. That's a big step forward. And so I think the fact that without going into how the income might be delivered, whether it's in this fund, whether it's somewhere else, just the conversion to an income and getting people to focus on that. As we all know, people don't have any idea about how much, you know, $200,000, $300,000 actually means in income terms. And if anything, it probably, you know, people tend to overestimate how much money it is, because it's a big sum of money in terms of their everyday lives. But it's actually, when you convert it to an income, it's $20,000, $30,000. Gee, that's perhaps not what I was hoping for. So that's a big step forward. I mean, I think, you know, having gone through it, I think the standards work well. The comments I've made are that some of the bits and pieces, some of the disclosures probably aren't as clear as they can be. We worked through with one fund for whom we did the numbers, applied the class order, and then they went and did focus groups before actually launching it out. And the focus group feedback was quite interesting. The age pension, while we're supporters of it, was not well understood. Things like your share of the age pension, because the assumption underlying it is that you assume they've got a spouse, you take the couple age pension entitlement and divide it by two. That's sort of a good stab at what perhaps is a real world assumption, given what we've said about most people arriving at retirement with a partner. But it's not well understood. What does my share mean? Most people, you know, aren't even clear that that's 50% of it, of a couple age pension. That's not very explicit in the standard wording. So things like that need to be tidied up. But by and large, I think it's a good stab. I don't think these things should ever be sort of set and forget. So I suspect that as funds adopt this, there'll be refinements. We should make the best stab we can to get it right, but I suspect there'll be refinement over time as well.
So the question back to Glenn from the audience. So for the super performance dashboard, do you think it is better for APRA, maybe ASIC, or the Institute or another independent organisation to develop and maintain a comprehensive online performance comparison tool?
I would speak from... Well, can I say that the facts are that there are a number of industries and organisations out there that have been preparing comprehensive performance information for superannuation funds for 40 years. My expectation will be, and this is probably one of my concerns about the dashboard is that what will happen is that if the net return is actually determined to be the comparative metric that superannuation funds, that members are supposed to use, and once we talk about members, you're going to have the press, you know, so that the public suddenly start to use as the metric to compare superannuation funds, what will happen is that there will be organisations that will actually prepare league tables of this. In fact, and I think APRA, you know, one of the things, APRA's going to provide this information in their reporting. So what you're going to find is that there will be organisations that will actually prepare net returns and have a list of superannuation funds and the net returns, and that will become the de facto basis that superannuation funds can be compared on. Now, the problem, ideally, the organisations, as I said, if we have organisations that already provide comprehensive information on superannuation funds and a whole series of metrics. So they exist already and those are reported in the public press. So I don't think we need anything new there. The problem that I see is that those same organisations will in fact start preparing, but they will be forced to start preparing the same sort of metrics using what's actually in the dashboard, and that information will in fact be provided to the public. It will become front page news on the Daily Telegraph. You know, it'll be the number that will actually be promulgated, and you'll see it'll be the number that these organisations put into their advertising. You'll see television shows with talking about their net returns and all that sort of stuff. So it's not the providing those information, it's actually the fact that once net return is actually calculated in accordance with the requirements of the dashboard, this information will be out there, organisations will provide this information, APRA will provide this information, and then that will be in the public arena. And it doesn't matter whether the net investment return is actually there, it'll be the other number that will be actually promulgated.
So just starting down this end, there's another question from the floor, but I think goes across the whole panel, so be prepared. So what do you think the risks are, the main risks from your perspective, at least anyway, that the super industry faces over the years ahead?
Okay, so two things from me. One, I guess, squarely from an APRA perspective, and one probably just a more personal view, but... I think the quality of data that trustees have is a big risk. Over the last couple of years, the sort of horror stories or war stories that were thrown out to us at APRA as examples of poor quality data were quite extraordinary. And I think a lot of the discussion today has centred on really knowing the member and knowing the member's situation, and if the funds don't have accurate birth dates, how do they even know if someone's approaching an age where some of the post-retirement issues become more pertinent? So we are worried that there is poor quality data out there, and I think part of the struggles that some funds are having with our data collection is because they're realising that they don't actually have good enough quality data in some of the areas. So that's one risk that we're watching. Another risk I think that has come out through the various conversations in industry forums and things that I've had over the last couple of years is self-managed super in the post-retirement phase. So what with APRA regulated fund where there's a trustee there making decisions, that's one thing, but where the trustee perhaps gets dementia and is sitting on a large asset, what are we going to do as an industry in that space, given that you know, a large amount of money has moved from the APRA regulated space to self-managed?
I guess from a personal perspective, I would say probably the for me, one of the bigger risks is just going to be credibility, and that obviously election coming up, potential change of government. We've already gone through a lot of reforms, a lot of changes, and one of the things that always happens is just more changes get piled on further and further and further. And I guess what it comes down to, you know, from a consumer point of view, they just see these constant changes happening and they just get overly confused as to what's going on. And just being able to, I guess, I personally think it's just that being able to, I guess, communicate with the general public and giving them some certainty and some confidence in the system, and just being knowing that what they have now is what's going to be there down the track, because obviously with all these changes which do occur, they always get concerned as to what's going to happen and if what we're saying is now is going to be there in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time.
Thank you. SMSFs. I think about that. To me, that is the biggest risk associated with the move to everything in superannuation being about the individual rather than being about the group. So if I pick up a different point on SMSFs, I agree completely with that point about the frail stage. What's going to happen? They work really well now, SMSFs, for many people, but what happens in 20 years? That's a really important point. But there's a point now, and that's the point about the consequences of 40% of the assets in superannuation Australia being in SMSFs and increasing. What does that mean for investment managers? What does that mean for diversification? What does that mean for the whole way the superannuation industry works? We've seen Astara. What happens when people take advantage of individuals who don't know? You transform that and the experts are becoming the suburban accountants. To me, that is a risk for superannuation. And, of course, all that comes outside APRA. It's ATO land. To me, that's the biggest risk.
So from a retirement phase perspective, which is the way I guess I look at this, I can see two related risks. One is the expectations gap between what the current cohort expect and aspire to have throughout their retirement and the reality of what's there. And while I think the things we've talked about today, you know, projection tools and the like and better engagement can go some way to doing that, I think, you know, the reality of inadequate savings in the past and constraints on top-ups and, you know, the reasonable prospect of lower returns in say the next 10 years than what that cohort has become accustomed to, I think both go together to really create this gap. And so while that's there, I think the crystallisation of that and the outworkings of that and the stress on the system that will create as people try and get more out of a pot that's not adequate, perhaps take inappropriate investment risks. I think perhaps SMSFs are in some way a symptom of that. I think that's a macro risk. The other side of it is sort of looking at more from the sort of system point of view, is, you know, inertia, you know, trustee inertia, and perhaps aligned with that is, you know, fatigue from constant regulatory change means that while there's work to do in this space at a fund level, it often gets crowded out by the the urgent rather than focusing the important, which is designing and coming up with better post-retirement default solutions.
I think the major risk, all of those other areas are problem areas, but I see that the major risk for superannuation is the concentration risk, that what we're seeing is increasing smaller numbers of larger and larger and larger superannuation funds. And so although I think it's tiny, but what we have is the potential for any one of those superannuation funds to actually make some decisions, particularly in the investment area. I'm not, in terms of administration, I mean, I've been involved in administering superannuation funds for 40 years, and I can tell you, if you've got people involved in superannuation, they will make mistakes, right? There are always going to be mistakes in superannuation administration. There is always going to be bad data. If you've got hundreds of thousands of millions of people in a superannuation fund, you know, you're going to have bad data. But I'm more concerned about, we've got one superannuation fund which said, you know, we're allowed to have 50% of their assets invested in illiquid assets, right? Basically, we had the GFC, and suddenly that the members of that fund suffered substantially. And so the risk that I see and what I think APRA really need to manage is to ensure that as we get most of the superannuation monies of most Australians concentrated on a handful of large superannuation funds, that those large superannuation funds are never allowed to make mistakes that will in fact endanger the assets of those funds. Because what will happen if we have one of those large funds, if it goes broke, the whole credibility of the superannuation industry will be destroyed. And that'll in fact impact on what the government does, it'll impact on what the voters do to governments and all that sort of thing.
Are there any other questions from the floor at this stage? We seem to run out of SMS text messages. SMSF. Okay, I've got another one just for Nick before we wind up. Then we're seeing super funds. What are they doing in practice to help members with the dignity of their members in retirement?
Well, probably my response to the last question indicated that I think there's more sort of thought than action going on at the moment. So hopefully with the bulk of the MySuper regulations or implementation being behind them, they can actually start paying more attention to it. The funds that, you know, that we see, they're thinking more about, you know, what are their members' risk profiles and how do they best adapt or design a product to actually match those. So I think the groundwork, if you will, is actually doing a lot more work on understanding members, segmenting them, assessing their risk tolerance, you know, focus groups to understand what they actually want, getting closer to them that way. And so funds, I think, have been doing a lot of work in that space. What you see at the other end is a sort of slower burn, because it's tricky for funds with disparate groups of members, some very high net wealth people coming out who obviously are at risk of going to SMSFs, and funds are concerned about curtailing that to the extent they can. But, you know, a large number of members coming through with what we might call, in terms of the numbers I showed earlier, inadequate assets. So it's a very hard question at that end to say what can we actually do to help this person, when the fundamental problem here is that they haven't got enough savings. Obviously, if we'd been able to rectify that 10 years earlier, we could have helped them. But if they're coming out with $50,000, $80,000, $100,000, it's very hard to talk about lifetime solutions. I think what we are seeing, you know, on the ground, though, is some sort of specifically labelled products. So you're seeing income stream defaults coming in. Sometimes they're just simple sort of life cycle or de-risking type products, which, depending on a fund's individual view on a sort of life cycle approach, at least is trying to actually sort of adapt or map a solution onto what they see as the members' risk tolerance. So whatever else and however inadequate their assets might be, there's a sense that most members don't want the sort of volatility, you know, into their advanced retirement years that they've had throughout. So some sort of sensible scaling down to a less volatile option on a default basis is the sort of thing we're seeing at the moment. And I think other options like, you know, annuities and insurance will come over time, but not so much at the moment.
And Katrina or Rod, just one of the things, like, I guess another risk that we all face is also around technology, and it's also a thing that we can take advantage of. But in terms of communications with members, do you have any views yet or thoughts on the electronic world and the impact of that and making, I mean, at the moment you're allowed to, members can opt in to receive information. How do you see that progressing over time and how funds can communicate electronically with their members?
Well, it's probably more of an ASIC issue than an APRA issue as far as sort of communication with members and things. But I think that has been another sort of very interesting part of the reforms is that with all of the changes, there's been the need for some mail-outs to members to inform what's happening around MySuper and what's happening around accrued default amounts and things like that. And where email addresses don't exist for members, just the sheer process that needs to be gone through and the cost involved for contacting every member of a fund is enormous. So to the extent that communication could be electronic in the future, I guess it goes to the knowing the member and actually having up-to-date contact details with them, but it would actually mean that communication could be done a lot cheaper and in a more timely way.
And I'll quickly get this last one that did come in just as a follow-up question. So following off from Glenn's point, you can read that for yourself. APRA have been broadly encouraging funds to merge to better access economies of scale, but do you have a view on the too big to fail?
APRA hasn't really been encouraging funds to merge. You know, there are some really well-run small funds out there and we've known about them for a while and expect them to still be in the market. I think the issue of too big to fail, if you just look internationally, the largest funds we have in Australia are still sort of $50 billion compared to the $200 billion pension funds in Canada or the Netherlands. So we're still quite small, I guess, compared to the largest funds out there. But as things do progress, you know, in 5 years' time, we might be in a situation that you were describing, and then I think as we're approaching that, the issue of too big to fail will definitely be on our minds. Mm.
So essentially across a lot of the panel today, the industry's coped with a lot of change over the last few years, and that's going to be ongoing. I've heard a consistent theme that it's been a great start across a lot of areas, but there's plenty of work to be done. But the good news is that the industry associations, professions and the regulators are all working together much better than historically, so we're making good progress together to work on the good start that we've built. And the focus is now moving more to the consumers and the outcomes for consumers in terms of an income for retirement, but also we're going to have a lot more information available to consumers and what how that's disclosed, how that's disclaimed, and how that's reported and educated and passed on to members is going to be an even more critical process going forward than it has been. So just put your hands together for all of the speakers, please. Just to wrap up my part of the session, just to remind you to put in the fill out the feedback forms are available at the reception area, but also through the app. And at this stage, I'll just hand back over to John to wrap up the morning.
Thanks, Andrew, and I'd ask you just to join me in giving Andrew a very special thanks for his able chairing. That was a great session. Thanks, Andrew.